Accession number 27813, Mr. Jack Ray, Reel 1. Now, we're doing this interview with you as a backup to a book that you've produced, which is called Kiwi Spitfire Ace, produced by Grub Street in 2001, a signed copy of which is in our library. But we're particularly interested in the sections when you were in operation with the RAF at Malta, and then again when you were a prisoner of war in Germany. So we're just going to concentrate on those periods. But we'd like you to, if you could, sum up your early life to explain to people very briefly how you came to be in Malta in the RAF.
As obviously it came out with the outbreak of war and people calling for volunteers, and as a young man, I guess we had, and we were fairly orientated to British support. At those days, we were pretty proud to be part of the British Empire, and so when volunteers were called, it was a case of decision as to what force we would volunteer for. And we really, being young people, crazy on motorbikes, crazy on speed, we really only had one choice, or two, and that the two became Fleet Air Arm or the RAF. So I had a great friend, a chap called Hill Boucher, and myself, and we decided let's go for the Air Force, and we applied together and were called to join in 1940, September 1940, we enrolled, and that's where our life began, flying.
Now could you just very quickly take us through your training?
That beautiful little tiger moth was the first experience that we had of jumping into the air. Hill was a damn sight better pilot than me to start with, and he seemed to have a natural ability that frustrated me for a little while, but once we got going and we enjoyed the flying, we had a glorious big mountain right beside us. Our early training was at a place called New Plymouth in New Zealand, and there was an 8,000 foot mountain not far from us, so it made actually flying could be quite dangerous if you watch yourself. And the ecstatic effect of being asked to do our first big cross country from New Plymouth to Hawera, which was about an hour and a half to 2 hours flying, we just thought this was fabulous to take off on our own and sail across in a headwind and a little tiger moth. It took us exactly twice as long to go one way as the other, because once we got with the following wind, the little tiger moth just whistled along, and that was our joy of flying at that period. From there, of course, we had to face up other things. We get into the next thing we were thrown into was the Hawker Hind, which was had a beautiful big Rolls-Royce Kestrel, as far as we were concerned, having this large engine to take us in, and we could climb up, and they allowed us to get up at about 15,000 feet without oxygen, as long as we didn't stay longer than a quarter of an hour. At all, we just loved flying these. They were like an overpowered tiger moth. But then, after that, of course, it was a case of off to Britain by ship, and we went by ship across Canada. We went with the first of the Empire Training School, and there were hundreds of Australian New Zealanders on the ship who were going to be trained for their pilots in Canada. We arrived in Britain from Glasgow, shot down on the railway line, and arrived in London, went to Uxbridge, had the thrill of meeting the Queen. Even that, to young people, it was all quite an experience. We were taken to Balmoral Castle. And
do you mean Princess Elizabeth?
Princess Elizabeth and the Queen.
Sorry, you're right.
The Queen and the Princess, and the two, Princess and Princess Margaret. And they met us with the little dogs trailing behind them, and we lined up. And it was quite impressive for fellows that had come out of Kiwi land and to look across from quite incredible, untouched Balmoral Castle at that time, and around us was bomb damage everywhere. And we suddenly realised that we were coming into a war zone. We were no longer in a peaceful little place in New Zealand where the animals still grazed peacefully, and suddenly we were at war. And when we were then posted, the joy of us, of course, we had dreamt, the two of us, we'd dreamt of becoming fighter pilots. But it was actually, by the description of one of my friends, was that it was a giant lottery when you arrived in London as to what happened to you, whether you were put on bombers, whether you were put on a coastal command, or fighters. And we'd been told for quite a while that the best way to get into a fighter was to ham-fist your flying and do everything so that you weren't the most safe pilot. And that all that false information was fed to us, but however we believed it at the time and hoped for the best. And to our joy, I was posted to Heston to convert the Spitfires. I hadn't even thought about it until that stage suddenly hit me when I got there. No one was going to fly dual with you when you went on that Spitfire. You're going to get up there all by yourself. And that made you think for a little bit. And they had a mock-up cabin of a Spitfire on a concrete block, and you could climb into this thing and to see what it was like with the controls and put on an oxygen mask. We'd never had an oxygen mask before. We'd never had any intercom. We'd never even had a convertible prop. So all of a sudden, we were jumping into a completely new phase of flying. And yet, there was a war on, and we were quite impressed, because in Heston at that time, a landmine had only crashed in there just the night before and blown half the hangar out. So it was quite a shock to us. But anyhow, I got into the Spitfire for the first time, opened the throttle, and frightened the hell out of me with the flames pouring out of the exhaust. Screamed off all right, but the moment I got up, I got completely lost. By the time I had got my head out of the cabin and looked around, there were so many buildings around me. I'd been used to flying with nothing but paddocks under me, and I was literally, I couldn't find the aerodrome for quite a while. And by that time, I was screaming over North Holt at great speed. Demney hit the balloon barrage before I got back, and then promptly smashed the Spitfire on the landing. Now, I did a great takeoff from my first start. That's how I was welcomed into Britain.
Now, you went through, we wish we had time, but we can't go through all your training. And we'll talk about the Spitfire in action. I think that's where we'll do the detail. Where did you go from Heston?
Posted to Red Hill. We were wrapped into the New Zealand squadron, which at that time was at Red Hill, associated with Kenley Wing. And within only probably about a week, and we were on operations, climbing up into formations, and it was pretty impressive at that stage to suddenly find you were really at war with hardened, experienced Luftwaffe pilots circling around us. And
now, that was with which squadron were you with?
485 Squadron, associated to the Kenley Wing.
Now, are there any particular stories stand out in your mind from that time? Just, you know, one or two, just to give us the flavour of what it was like.
If you want the thing that I remember the most, it's not necessarily the happiest moment, was to watch one of my fellow pilots dive crash just because something went wrong with his oxygen. We flew away, we screamed at him, we yelled at him, and he went into crazy formation. This is halfway across to France on operation. And he just dived into the channel. Couldn't stop him. Just something went wrong with his oxygen.
And he fainted.
If we could see him lying in the cockpit. Yeah.
And you were flying with them for quite a while.
Yes, quite a while.
Was that where you began to shoot, to score your first victories? Or?
Yes, one or two, because we come into this thing that I've developed a thing about quite early on. I don't know why I've developed a big thing, but this tail end Charlie and the line of formation that we had.
Tell me about that, because that was, I noticed that in your book, and it struck me as a ridiculous formation.
Well, the hard heads at the top in the RAF at that time still stuck to this line astern, which meant that there was a number one leader, the number two, you were the number two to him, and you had to fly under his tail virtually, and you were supposed to be looking behind and protecting his tail. If you try to do those two things at once, you find it a little bit tricky. And there's another two behind you, so that there's two, and right at the end was your tail end Charlie. And in that formation of the squadron was three tail end Charlies. Well, of course, our hardened, experienced Luftwaffe boys used to float around behind there, sitting up sun, and occasionally they'd dive down way behind you and come up underneath you. And if you were unwary at that moment, then that was your curtain. But you couldn't convince them, because it meant you were flying slower, you were less aggressive, you were fully defensive, and we just couldn't see the damn sense of this formation, but they stuck with it.
Was it a local formation, or was it an RAF formation? You know,
it was an RAF, not a New Zealand one, it was an RAF.
And not just the Kenley?
No, the whole lot. Of course, the others were a little different, you see, and less disciplined. For example, the Northolt wing of the Poles, they were a highly aggressive group of pilots, and you could quite often see them break out of formation as if to say, to hell with this, and they'd dive in and ignore it. But we were told to be disciplined. We stayed with this silly formation, and occasionally we watched our fellow pilots getting picked off, and including they tried a couple of times with myself, and I came back on my own, and that's a quite a lonely trip on your own, because once you break off and on your own, you are really very vulnerable, and it's a case of whether you're lucky to get back.
Any actions in particular in the air you remember from that time? I know from your thing that you don't remember all of them. In your book you say it's just one-line descriptions often.
No, you fight for your life all the way back with about four of the enemy attacking all the time when you're on your own. And I think you'll recall from reading the book that where I was pretty stewed up by the time I got back to the coast and was nearly out of fuel and called out for an urgent vector to get to the nearest drone, I got it, set my course. Suddenly I saw the field below me, put my flaps down, put my wheels down and landed. And what I actually discovered after I stopped the motor and looked around is I hadn't landed on a drone at all. I'd landed on a fake drone surrounded by cardboard replicas, and I couldn't believe I'd even successfully got down. And an old countryman came up to me and said, "Ye fella, you shouldn't be down here. It is not safe here." And I said, "Where the hell am I?" And he said, "Oh," he said, "well, there's a drone over there on the hills, and that's probably where I should have been." And I sat for a few minutes. I'd stopped the motor, and I sat for a minute. I thought, "My God, I can't face the fellows of the squadron with this. I've got to get out of here." And so I took the silly risk of deciding to take off again. And he showed me a way that I could sort of steer through these cardboard replicas and get off. And probably one of the dumbest risks I've ever taken in flying, but I knew I was very low on fuel. I knew I only had probably only a few minutes more flying, and I'd use a lot getting off. And I took off, got over the hills. Sure enough, there was the drone. I landed, and I ran out of fuel just soon after I'd landed.
Now, how long were you with 485 Squadron? It wasn't that long.
1941 to must be quite a while, because it was I joined them in early 1941 and I left for Malta in April 42, so it's practically a year, I should think.
Now, what were the circumstances of you being posted to Malta? Was that just the end of a tour, or was it a special request?
I often thought about that myself, and I don't know. I think it, looking at the things I've learned since, that I was one of the few that was making up for a horrible mistake made at high command. Because when I arrived on the aircraft carrier, I discovered the entire squadron that they were sending to Malta with these valuable Spitfires had never done any operations. There were only about three that had ever seen an operation in that squadron. And that was a shock, and it's not to discover.
Well, tell me about the voyage out. We'll do that. I mean, how did you get out there? You went on the you went with an aircraft, didn't you?
It was quite impressive.
But you weren't
attached
to a squadron, were you? You were just.
I was attached then to 603. I didn't know I was, but I learned later I was attached to the City of Glasgow 603 Squadron. Lord David Douglas Hamilton was the CO of the squadron.
And what do you remember?
A magnificent man, but he'd come straight out of training command.
And what do you remember about the voyage out on the aircraft? It was HMS. It was American.
The USS Wasp.
Yeah, sorry, I just
you nearly threw me there.
And what do you remember of that voyage out?
Only the immense luxury of the ship, the good food. We jumped straight from a rationed Britain onto a ship that had everything. They had perfect food. They had maple syrup and all the rest of it, and easy overs for breakfast. You know, it was quite a staggering contrast. Suddenly, it was a highly efficient ship, and beautifully comfortable and well equipped. And the crew were very nervous. This was the first operation of this American crew at that time, and they were very jumpy, particularly because they'd had to sacrifice quite a few of their fighter defence to fit all the Spitfires on board. There were 48 Spits crowded into that hangar, and they had a few of their own for defence, but but most of them had been left at Gibraltar. And we were very nervous of the length of that deck, because when we looked at the Spitfire with a 90-gallon tank in its belly, and we were told, by the way, of course, that we could only carry 10 pounds of our own personal gear. And I weighed my Rolleiflex camera I had, and that weighed 4, and that left a couple of pair of underpants and a singlet or two, I think, and that was it.
Now, this was in the preparation, because you were going to fly from HMS Water to Malta.
We were going to fly to Malta from Algiers.
Now, tell me that story about the weight, because it is an amusement, because you didn't stick to it, did you?
No.
Well, it nearly had unfortunate consequences for someone else.
Yes,
now,
well,
can you tell us the whole story, just as if I'd never heard it before?
Yes, well, of course, what really happened is that every day on the ship, the rumour would get out there was a shortage of ham, a shortage of so Spam was something you could buy easily, of course, on the ship, but it weighed a lot, and we were buying this stuff frantically. I'd be climbing up onto the spit that was there hanging on the ropes, and with a pocket knife screwdriver and undoing the panel screws, stuffing the stuff up, and I'd go back to bed that night and worry myself sick, because I'd get up the next morning, have a look at the length of the carrier and think, I'm never going to get off this thing with 90 gallons of gas underneath and all the stuff I'm putting in. And so when it got nearly time to take off, I started to go back and nervously take one or two tins out again. But I still knew I had far too much weight on. And I was still worried, and all of a sudden, David Douglas Hamilton came in the night before due to take off to Kakadu, and he said, I'm sorry, he said, I've had to change. You can't take your aircraft, so I wanted to change you to another section. And so he said, you take, and he gave me the name of this Canadian boys, you take his plane, he can take yours, but you haven't got any time to change anything. So I had to go to this poor Canadian and say, well, look, fella, this aircraft you're taking off might be a little bit overweight. But I sort of gently sort of, when you think about it, it was silly to say to him, wasn't it? Because I told him to take care when he was getting off. I'm sure he was intended to take care anyway. But the poor man, he was a pretty nervous young fellow, and he had a sort of an urgent sniff, this fellow, and his sniff grew a bit more, I think, after I told him he had this extra weight.
Did you tell him how much or what you'd
do? No, I didn't. I didn't have the heart to tell him. I could do not a damn thing about it. And anyhow, I got off ahead of him, and so I only heard later that his plane went off the bow and just hung above the waves for many miles before the poor man got it into the air. But however, he arrived in the island. And soon after, I was sort of looking around to see if I could see what should have been my aircraft. I spotted it and went over, and there was a Maltese chap with a bit of a hand truck that was helping me to unload a parachute and gear. And he came over and followed me, went over to it, and this poor man had to watch me unscrew the bits of the panels and all the stuff come out of the aircraft. I felt so guilty I gave him half of it, so he scored out of it anyway.
Now, there was a problem about aircraft landing. I mean, because it didn't go entirely smoothly on this occasion, did it? Because besides that sort of self-caused, the Luftwaffe arrive, don't they?
Soon after, yes.
So tell me, what is the problem? I mean, what could be done about protecting aircraft when they arrived?
Well, you imagine it was, because you ask these questions after, why didn't they prepare better and so on. But you see, there was no refueling tanks on our drones at all. We had to fill all our planes with 4-gallon tins, and you can imagine how long it put 90 gallons of gas in with 4-gallon tins. That's apart from rearming your guns and so on. And by the time they refueled a few of these aircraft, there was about 100 plus Luftwaffe over the top dropping bombs. And then they continued to bomb all night, and we had 4 serviceable out of our lot, 20-odd, that landed on Tokali the next morning.
So 20 were unserviceable?
All unserviceable.
Would they be lost, or would they be cannibalised?
Well, some of them were burnt to pieces. Others, my particular aircraft, that poor Canadian boy, it burnt to the frazzle. And from then on, as you use the word cannibalise, that's exactly what they had to do. And the men worked day and night keeping these planes flying. And of course, the big question was asked, why weren't we better equipped for it? And so when the next lot of the Wasp, which were coming later, it was highly organised, and they said to hell with security, because the argument was that the moment you start building extra pens and you get prepared with loads of stacks of petrol beside each pen and get them highly organised, then of course the Underground knew immediately and that there was more spits due to come. But it was better to forget about the security and get prepared, and this is what they did this time.
Now you mentioned it there, so can we talk about it? What were the pens? Were they, I presume,
sandbags. Sandbag after sandbag, and hand-filled by pilots, ground crew. We had hundreds of shipwrecked sailors, you know, as extra labour. They came and helped. Army boys came, and we built up pen after pen.
And what were they like? Can you describe them so you can sort of picture them?
It was just a defence, just a U-shaped defence that actually the Spitfire just tucked into.
How thick? The walls, I mean.
In height, it would have been about 7 foot high. They were good, effective defence. In other words, it had to be a direct hit to destroy an aircraft.
7 foot high, how wide? 4 foot, 5 foot?
30-odd feet for the wings. So.
Oh, no, I mean the walls, sorry.
Oh, walls.
7 foot high.
Two thicknesses bags of cement, that's probably...
About 5 foot.
Yes, 4 or 5 feet, yep.
So really layered and quite strong.
And lots and lots of wood.
Covered with camouflage?
Or yep, and topped over with camouflage, yes.
But no overhead roofing other than camouflage?
Not too many of those were roofed, but some of them had netting over them. But the majority, it was just purely protection against the shrapnel from the shot.
Now, where was the airfield? What was it called, the airfield that you'd landed at?
Tikali is the one that I operated from.
That's T-I-K...
Lots of ways they spell it in Malta, but T-A-K-A-L-I, Tikali.
That's the way in your book, and what do you think?
Right below them, Mdina, the holy city of Malta. We slept and lived in Mdina, and Lord Haw-Haw used to pump it over every night on his German defence, German propaganda, of the pilots who skulked behind the walls of the Mdina, the holy city. They reckoned that that's why we went there, and we quite agreed with him. We didn't mind.
Now, might as well look at your accommodation. What was your accommodation like in Mdina? What were you?
Ours wasn't too bad.
Billets, then?
Yes, because I was an NCO at that period. The officers had slightly better quarters, but we were billeted in a private Maltese home, actually. It was quite a luxury home with a garden in the centre, you know. At the room we had was absolutely bare, of course. We had a problem, of course, with us. Two or three things hit us when we came to Malta, if you want to get a picture of conditions. It didn't take us very long to get diarrhea. It was the worst thing. Malta dog, as we used to call it, and that and poor food. And we were faced with having to fly under pretty bad medical conditions. We weren't.
How bad was the diarrhea? Did it edge into dysentery, or was it, you know what I mean?
Well, you could get called for a scramble with a tear off, just putting a parachute on, have to take your parachute off and to pants down, that bad. It was quite serious at times. But it was worse that you blacked out fairly easily in combat, too, because you...
We'll come back to that. Now, so that was a problem. And what did you blame on that? Was it the food that was causing it,
the
or
food.
Was it the latrines?
It was food. Lack of food.
Now, what food were you getting?
Bully beef. McConaughey's. Bully beef. McConaughey's. That's about it. We had fruit, of course. But,
local fruit?
Yes. Occasionally, we would slip into a black marketplace and sort of gave us a which we knew was horse meat. We didn't ask any questions. But I don't think some of the chaps would have survived without the black market, frankly.
Was there a thriving black market?
No, I don't think so, no. Yet they were very loyal, most of the Malta, but I think they recognised that we did have to have something.
Now, so you were living in the billets. Now, what was the setup? Because when you arrived, you weren't in a squadron. You'd gone out with 603 squadron.
Yeah.
What was the situation when you arrived as to which squadron? Because that wasn't the squadron you were put in, was it?
No. You must have done your homework to know that. No, I went as part of 603, and the moment we got there, I was ecstatic to find out that the Maltese boys had said, to hell with this formation you were talking about earlier, and we were doing in Britain, and here we fly line abreast, the same as the Luftwaffe. We can fly aggressive, and we fly virtually either finger four or full line abreast. And so immediately they decided the boys better learn how to do it. So I went off in a section of four with two of them leading the squadron, who were high-ranking in our squadron, but had never done any operations, and one other New Zealander actually was flying the other side with me, and we were stooging around at around about 15 to 20,000 feet, and I saw a yellow-nosed 109, one of my old friends that I'd been seeing in the north of France, stooging up behind, very well back and very slowly, and I called up, warned the others that he was there, but I said, he's not attacked, just watch him, because I was looking for the second one. And the next minute there was a scream over the RT, look out Jack, and break, 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 and it was my New Zealand friend Mitchell who was on the other side. And by the time I broke, the cannon shells were smashing into my cockpit, and I was literally blown out of the sky. So, but at the split second that it hit my aircraft, I had opened my throttle wide, slammed into a steep turn, and at that moment, my throttle fell to pieces beside me, and I had no, and the control stick had gone, and I had a plane in a steep diving turn. And then I immediately pulled my Sutton harness pin to get out, and the G-force was so great that instead of getting out, it threw me straight to the bottom of the cockpit. And so I was pinned into the bottom of the cockpit of the plane down full power. And it's one of those strange things you will never know, that all of a sudden I'm grateful to the fact that the Spitfire decided to do a buck and a turn and threw me out. And if it hadn't thrown me out, that I would never have got out myself, because the G-force was too great. And when I got out, of course, I immediately grabbed for my to pull pin and couldn't find it. My hand was panicking and feeling, and I couldn't, it wasn't there. And suddenly a little friend said to me of a memory bank that I remember this amazing thing, you're hurling out in the space, and I suddenly remembered an instructor saying, if you can't find the pin, look for it. And that was a sensible suggestion, but I'd never thought of it. So I looked down when I was screaming down the wind, there it was, flying out in the breeze. And so I was lucky that it hadn't pulled that split second further. I'd never got out of the cockpit. So I pulled it, and then it was all peaceful, and I finished up landing on the drone. But unfortunately, I'd been silly enough to have, on my Mae West, I'd painted out, because our aircraft was never our own, we'd put the various aircraft we shot down, we'd put swastikas on the side of my Mae West. So when I crashed onto Malta, and a farmer came crashing over, and saw the swastikas and pulled his gun on me, and I began to think that was the end of my penny section. But some of the British 4th Buffs, always remember, some of the members of the 4th Buffs came dashing over the rocks and chased the Maltese away, and so that was one of my experiences of Malta.
And this is one of your first flights?
That was a good start, wasn't it?
And that's before you've been assigned to the squadron or not?
That's right, I was still part of 603 then.